Or Leningrad. The person who told me is a party member. He was at school with me. He says they're mining everything here in the northern sector. If they're doing that here, then it must be the same across the whole city. There are detonators ready, just waiting.
The whole city?
Yes. They stare at each other.
But how can there not be Leningrad any longer? It's impossible.
Yes, it's impossible, says Anna. But I believe him. He knew what he was saying. We'll blow it up rather than let them have it.
You can't think about all that, Anna. You've just got to think about now.
That's what I'm trying to do. But then you come, and you wake everything up. You make me feel things again, and I want to talk to you about them.
Well, that's good, isn't it? What's the point of being alive if you don't feel it? You might as well be under an anaesthetic.
Andriusha, it's different for you. I've got my father and Kolya. I've always had a child holding my hand, and I'm not even a mother. Sometimes I think I never will be. This'll be my life. This'll be what I have, if we don't all die. Don't you understand? I'm not complaining, I'm just telling you how it is. They are my responsibilities. Look at my father. Do you think he'll ever be...
He sees her feel for the difficult word. Normal, perhaps.
Himself.
All right. All those shorthands women use to him when they come into the ward with their baskets of bread and soup clutched in rough, red-knuckled hands.
He won't be able to work again, she says at last. And he'll need someone at home to look after him when I'm at work. I won't be able to leave him alone. How can we afford that on what I earn? Or is Marina going to stay? That's good in a way, but on the other hand, I'm never alone. I've never got time when someone isn't wanting something, expecting something.
You don't need to think about it all now.
Why are you saying that? Are you saying that because he's going to die? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
No, Anna, of course not.
Well, I'm sorry, André. I get angry. I'm not angry with you, but you see why I can't let myself think about other things now. I can't think about how I feel.
You want to. I know you want to.
Yes, but that's not the point. Anybody can give way sometimes.
Oh, for God's sake, Anna, what's that supposed to mean?
I don't know how to say it. It's this. You make me weak. I'm afraid of it. I'm afraid you'll weaken me.
I would never let you get pregnant. You know how careful I am.
That's wonderful. That solves all my problems. Doesn't it occur to you that not being pregnant really isn't all that much to hope for out of life?
Anna, he says, in the tone she loves. Two drawn-out syllables, as if he doesn't want to let go of her name. Anna. Anna, let's not quarrel.
I know. But you should be with your patients and I should be digging ditches.
In a minute.
You know I want you to stay. You know that.
Yes.
But we have to make sacrifices.
He is unbuttoning her jacket. Her breasts are squashed by the tight, ugly blouse she's wearing to match the ugly jacket. He undoes the buttons of the blouse, and there is the warm, deep crack between her breasts. He touches the line where her tan ends, then slides his hand down and finds her nipple. She kisses him, arching her back so that her breast fills his hand. Then she says, Marina, Kolya, and my father are all within 3 meters of us. They can even hear us breathing.
You don't want to make any more sacrifices.
You know I do.
But I can't. I must go. He watches her as she buttons up her blouse. She glances up and smiles a sudden, naked smile.
It's so stupid, isn't it? All the things we want and all the things we could have, and we might never be able to have any of them. You remember Katinka, the girl who died, the one I told you about? She was outraged by the idea that she might be going to die.
because that wasn't what she'd been promised. After all, she was only 15, and all her life everything had gone so well. Death was something that happened to other people, like failing an exam. Sometimes I think we should do everything, now, all at once, without stopping to think, because this might be the only time we've got. And I don't know if I hold back because I'm sensible, or because I'm scared. I would never hurt you. You might. And I might hurt you. I don't want any of that to happen. It won't happen. But sometimes I think I'm better on my own, Andryusha. Safer. I know this will sound stupid, because as you see, I'm surrounded by people all the time. But I've always felt as if I were alone. No, that's not right. I mean, on my own. Ever since my mother died. He folds his arms around her. He wants to make them so close that there is no room for words to come between them. In the little hallway, silent, they're safe. In the next room, Marina Petrovna is making onion soup and listening to Radio Leningrad, while Kolya sprawls on the floor, drawing pictures of tanks. His tanks are tiny, like insects crawling across white paper. There are houses and streets in his picture, but no people. There is a smell of onions and sickness in the room. Kolya's father lies on the sofa, exhausted by the effort of getting out of bed. From time to time he sips from the glass of tea beside him. There is the tea glass. There, his hand. Slowly, by an immense effort of will, he joins one to the other. The glass shakes as he lifts it to his lips. The tea slops, but doesn't spill. He sucks in a little. Sweet. Sweet. Suddenly the effort of holding the glass outweighs the bliss of sugar. He puts it down and lets himself sink onto the pillows Marina has packed around him. He feels himself falling, but with another effort he steadies himself. He is on the sofa. There are his legs, under the blanket. Everything is just as it should be. He patrols his thoughts until it is safe to relax and watch his son. He's going to be good at drawing, like Anna. But he's coming to the stage when they aren't satisfied with those sweeping, intuitive early drawings which we adults think are so wonderful. He wants to learn. How do you draw eyelashes? How do you draw a man so he looks as if he's really running? For a while his drawings won't be as good as they are now. He'll be struggling, and he'll get cross with himself and hurl his paper into the bin. I remember that stage so well, with Anna. That's beautiful, we'd say, but she'd screw up her face and say, no, it's not, it's all wrong, it's rubbish, I'm going to tear it up. Vera thought it might help if she had drawing lessons, even though she was only 7. And it turned out to be just the right thing. She stopped getting into a rage with herself, and all her enthusiasm came back. I would never have thought of the drawing lessons, but Vera had a feeling for things like that. When the sun gets as far as that cushion there, I can go back to bed. But not before. But the terrible thing about coming back to life is that you can't be at peace anymore. There are 1,000 things to torment you. Before, I didn't mind what happened. I could let it all slip away. I didn't listen to the radio, even though Marina has it on all the time. But now, I'm afraid, just like everyone else. When Marina takes the boy down to the air raid shelter, I'm afraid that I'll never see them again. I lie here. That's all I can do. I listen to the anti-aircraft guns, and sometimes I can hear planes. They aren't our fighters. They drum above the roof, and I find myself praying even though I never pray. Always the same words. If it falls, let it be a bomb, not an incendiary. The sheets stick to me with sweat. I'm not afraid of bombs. But if an incendiary took hold here, I wouldn't be able to get away. I'm afraid of that. Last night I dreamed of Marina and the child. They were trying to wade towards me through a river which was full of fire instead of water. But he slipped and went down, and then he floated away. Slowly, at first, then faster and faster, with the fire lapping around his head. Marina kept on looking at me. I knew she wanted to tell me why she hadn't rescued him. It was because it was too late for him. He would suffer too much if he was brought up into the air again. When I woke up, I was wet with sweat, and the guns were still crackling. They drop phosphorus bombs. Water can't put out phosphorus. It burns and burns. Last night there was a terrible screaming that went on, and I think it was that which made me dream about Kolia and the fire. Marina says they weren't human screams. A bomb hit the zoo, and the animals were wounded. Some of the cages were blown open, and the animals were running up and down the streets. I suppose they had to be shot in the end. Marina says they're not selling any food off the rations now. The restaurants are closed. She sits on my bed and tells me how many potatoes we've got left, how many onions, how many grams of lard. She counts them over aloud, then counts them again. We both enjoy it. If she stops, I ask her more questions. How many potatoes did you say exactly, Marina? Kolia loves peeping into the store cupboard and seeing how many jars there are. He doesn't try to touch anything. He stares solemnly for a while and then he says, "We've got lots of food, haven't we, Marina?" And she answers, "Yes, we're very fortunate." And he nods, satisfied, and goes back to his game. There's been further bombing of food stocks, but no one knows exactly where. Now we know that they don't just want to defeat us. They want to destroy us. Nothing in Leningrad matters to them at all. Not a stone or a child. Carthage must be destroyed. But there's freedom in knowing it. We can't make deals with them anymore. So much for our pact. We have no choice left. We have to resist. So I get out of bed and lie on the sofa for 2 hours. Doesn't sound much like resistance, does it? Wouldn't it terrify the Germans to know that Mikhail Ilyich Levin is staying alive and repeating poetry to himself? Onegin, do you remember that hour picked by fate for our meeting in the alley, in the garden? I can recite page after page. I close my eyes, and it's as if I had the book in front of me. I go through the section where Tatiana is lost in her dream. The plains, the fir trees, the ghostly light, and the creak of her footsteps through the snow. All these come to me so powerfully that it's as if I'd never really read about them or thought about them before. I almost say aloud that I'm sorry I didn't understand until now. My eyes fill with tears, and I don't know why. But I know that it's by these things, and nothing else, that we survive. Poetry doesn't exist to make life beautiful. Poetry is life itself. Tatiana will go on walking, the snow will fall, and Onegin will go on failing to love her, until it is much too late. Suddenly he'll recognize her for what she really is, and she'll explain to him why nothing more can happen between them. Everything that seems arbitrary has been laid down since time began. Soon the brown, earth-coloured landscape will be covered by snow. Always, every winter, there's a certain moment when you think that this time it will go on forever. The spring has forgotten us. Frost sinks deeper and deeper into the soil, driving out every sign of life. The sap will never rise again. And in a way you don't even want it to rise. Spring is painful and messy, and the earth smells foul when the crust of ice finally melts and breaks. Onegin, do you remember? And the ice starts breaking.
That's very good, Kolia. Just look at the way you've drawn that tank turret.
But I can't do the guns properly, Dad.
Do you know how to draw guns?
Give me your paper.
Gently now. I'll have a try.
Chapter 16.
Impossible arithmetic. No matter how often you do the sums, they can't work out. Evacuation started much too late, and too many people were evacuated into the path of the German advance. They poured back into the city, just ahead of the Germans. For every evacuee who left Leningrad for the Urals, three or four came in from the south and west, driven by the German advance. The city is packed. There are close to 3 million civilians, and then there's the military, nearly 500,000 of them. Divide Leningrad's food by all those mouths and see how quickly it vanishes once the supply lines are cut.
Here's a market stall, loaded with cabbages, buckwheat, lard, rye flour, wheat flour, sugar, honey, potatoes. The potatoes are solid, with firm, yellow flesh. The lard is of the finest quality, and the honey is on the comb, with its wax intact. Those fat, sweet cabbages with their crisp hearts are heaped up like chrysanthemums, green and bluish-purple, with first touch of frost prickling on their outer leaves. It's a dream stall, which could never really exist in a world of queues and shortages. But even if it did, how many could it feed? Imagine that 100 people crowd around it, grabbing the food and stuffing it into their bags. Suddenly there are 1,000, and now the crowd swells out of the square to pack the surrounding streets. There are 10,000. 50. 100,000. The imagination halts. It cannot grasp 1,000,000 flailing hands. Besides, the dream stall has long since been stripped and overturned. There's nothing left. But the hands are still there. They're held out, and they've got to be filled. For city people, it's hard to grasp that the supply chain has broken. It's kept them going all their lives, even though the system sometimes dissolves into chaos and prices go up and down like an undertaker's hat. Leningraders don't talk about shopping. They talk about getting hold of things. It's an art form you learn at your mother's side, queuing. But there's never just not been anything. We're not peasants in the Ukraine. Suddenly and sharply, it's obvious that cities only exist because everyone agrees to let them exist. It's crazy when you think of it. For millions of mouths to pack themselves into a couple of 100 square kilometres without a pig or a potato patch between them. It only works in the way that fiction works, by making people collaborate. All its life, the city has had the power to demand. It asks for milk, and before dawn, milk arrives. Field after field furs over with rye and barley. Pigs die choking on their own blood. Apples swell and fishermen drown. In the 6-mile-deep reaches of Lake Baikal, the sturgeons turn their snouts and swim into nets. The city doesn't ask for details, as long as the food keeps coming in. Leningrad mobilizes countryside, villages and towns for hundreds of miles around. Thousands of peasants who will never see the city spend their whole lives working to provide its food. Its web of trade relationships curls into millions of lives. Within the city, the process of transformation never stops. Raw wood pulp is transformed into books. Raw small-town boys are transformed into doctors and engineers. Would-be actors and filmmakers and dancers bursting with chaotic talent are shaped into finished artists. Leningrad can take anything, swallow it, and make it new. In packed trams and buses, members of the Writers' Union are jammed up next to steelworkers from the Kirov Works, who transform rivers of molten metal into KV tanks as the writers struggle to strike out words at white heat and pour them into new stories and poems. Leningraders deal in finished products. They are high up in the chain that leads from raw earth to luxury goods. Most of them will never eat caviar. But they know that caviar grows in jars, in GORT stores, not within a fish. They understand that milk doesn't come from cows, but from shops. Years of food shortages, rations and queuing have had the odd, contrary effect of making them less likely to panic when times get tough. They're so used to bread queues and scoured empty shelves in shops. They believe in their bones that if you walk far enough, have the right contacts, join every queue and wait for as many hours as it takes, in the end you'll go home with something in your shopping bag. It could be a few frostbitten turnips, a precious, fragrant 100 grams of coffee, a few gnarled apples from a kolkhoz stall, or a piece of sausage. Sometimes it won't be much more than a couple of onions and 50 grams of lard to make onion soup. But tonight, at least, you'll eat. And tomorrow is another day. The wheels will turn, the web will stretch. There'll be an unexpected delivery of pickled cucumbers or cranberries from the Ladoga marshes, all drawn to the magnet of the Leningrad markets. And with any luck, you'll be there, bag at the ready, first in the queue. This is how it has always worked. Like a body that cannot stop believing in an amputated, ghostly limb, so the city continues to believe in its supply chains long after they have been severed. All those millions of mouths, lips open, teeth bite and grind, salivary glands flood mouths with rich saliva to moisten the food and begin its digestion. Rhythmic waves of peristalsis send the food into the centre of the body. Energy begins to flow. Starches convert to sugar, and the body floods with warmth, energy, and hope. Lips shine with grease. The skin temperature rises slightly, and a faint pearling of sweat appears on the forehead. Life is good. The mouths of Leningrad continue to open and swallow. The gummy, toothless mouths of babies fasten onto their mother's nipples. Old, toothless mouths mamble black bread dipped in tea. Ravenous 17-year-old boys, still growing, cram their mouths with anything they can find. The question which arithmetic can't answer has got to be addressed by someone. There is this much food, and it is not being replaced. If no further supplies come into the city, how long will it last? How many times can these 3.5 million mouths open and still be filled? Dmitri Pavlov, newly arrived from Moscow, is the man who must attack the question, even if he cannot answer it. The brutal truth of the situation belongs to him, and he knows it to the core. Before long, the rest of Leningrad will know it too, not with their brains, but in their bellies. The entire city is a stone island now and has got to depend upon its own resources. But you can't eat stone, or the magical prospect of the Neva at dawn. Nor can you derive calories from apartment buildings, armaments factories, icons, or munition works. The history of Leningrad, Petrograd, St. Petersburg, may stretch back to the moment Peter put his iron mark on the marshes of the Neva. But you can't eat history. Pavlov has the power to do anything, though nobody, as he observes, can fold a piece of paper more than 7 times. Really? Can't you? But of course you can if it's a big enough sheet. Silently, Pavlov hands over a large sheet of high-quality thin paper and watches his colleague fold it. Once. Twice. 3 times. This is easy. But at the 8th fold, the man looks up, pained, although still smiling. Do you know, you're quite right. I would never have believed it. Even if that paper were as big as Lake Ladoga, it still wouldn't fold. We cannot change the laws of nature. Pavlov writes more lists, calculates figures, and works out his plans. There is silence, except for the scratching of his pen, the crackle of papers as he checks statistics, and the sound of typing from the next room. In the outer office, the phone rings constantly, but Pavlov pays it no attention. The calls will be from managers of local food storage units, slaughterhouses and depots, ringing in with the latest statistics which he has requested. He wants to know exactly what Leningrad holds. No rough calculations. He doesn't want any fantasies about how many cabbages may still lie unharvested in suburban gardens. Above all, he doesn't want optimism. He wants the detail. No rounding up of figures. No hoping against hope that somehow supplies may get through when it is impossible for them to get through. For that is what the besieging army intends,
Pavlov has grasped that from the beginning. They have dug in, and they'll hold on, relying on hunger and winter to open the gates of Leningrad to them. The panzer divisions may have been transferred away from the Leningrad front, but a ring of steel holds Leningrad tight. Every so often a young woman comes in from the outer office with a long, flimsy strip of paper, covered in typewritten columns, and lays it down at his side. Pavlov drinks in these statistics at a glance and adds them to his calculations.
"It's the same with our reserves,"
he announces suddenly to the colleague, who keeps glancing at the folded sheet of paper, as if perhaps he might have done it another way and succeeded with the eighth fold.
"I'm sorry? Our reserves. Here. According to these figures, at present we have 25,000 pigs in the Leningrad area. Some on the hoof, some already slaughtered. Sounds a lot, doesn't it?"
"Well, I should say so.
But we are consuming meat at the rate of 250 tons a day.
Tell me,
how long will we be able to continue to fold that particular piece of paper?"
"Forgive me, I don't know exactly how much a pig actually weighs."
"Then find out. These are the things we must all know, facts. We have got to know the facts, not what we think will happen or hope will happen. For a start, we must put out of our minds any expectation of further supplies reaching us in the foreseeable future."
"But, excuse me, surely it's still possible to bring in supplies by water over Lake Ladoga?"
"Not enough. The supply chain is too weak, and we haven't got the infrastructure. There are not enough landing stages or barges, and the railway line is hopelessly inadequate. We'll exploit that route as far as we can, but our boats are sitting ducks for German bombers. For the time being, I have decided to discount from my calculations any supplies which may reach us via the Ladoga route. We must be realistic. Facts are our business, not pious hopes. We have 3.5 million people to feed for an indefinite period, and at the present rates of consumption, we won't do it. The ration must be cut again."
Both men would say, if you asked them, that they are working in concentrated silence. They have long since ceased to hear the sirens, the screech of fighter planes struggling to defend the city, and the explosions, which are so loud that they seem not to be heard, but to thud deep into the stomach, like blows. They do not try to put what is happening into words. If they did, they would probably reach for clichés.
"Leningrad is fighting for its life. The people of Leningrad will defend their city to the last drop of blood. The fascist invaders will be repulsed by the determination of the Soviet people."
Pavlov would reach for the clichés, simply because to do so saves time. Pavlov is a man in his prime. He reaches out for a paper without looking at the woman who brings it, and she plants it eagerly in his hand. From time to time he blinks and runs his fingers through thick, vigorous hair which is gritty with dust. Hair, skin and mouths are full of dust these days, from the bombardment. When these old buildings are shelled, they send clouds of blackened, ancient dust into the air which drift and settle everywhere. Pavlov's skin has a faintly kippered smell from the smoke which hangs low over Leningrad. He coughs and seizes another strip of figures. "Excuse me," ventures the colleague at last, "how long do you calculate that the blockade will continue?"
"How should I know?"
snaps Pavlov.
"The duration of the blockade is not within my area of competence. Not only do I not know the answer, but the answer doesn't even interest me. I've not been sent here to speculate. Facts are what I need."
He sits back and knuckles his eyes with his fists. His eyes are raw with sleeplessness, and they itch all the time. It's the dust. Sometimes lines of figures dance as he studies them. Already he is afraid that mistakes have been made. If the decision to implement tougher cuts in the rations had been taken 2 weeks ago, thousands of tons of supplies would still be held in reserve. It's no good making cuts on an ad hoc basis in response to each new crisis. There must be a properly thought-through and managed policy to deal with improper, unmanageable realities.
"We must continue to fold our piece of paper," he says, without opening his eyes. "Even when it becomes impossible."
He begins another list, heading it with the words, "other resources." Warehouses, depots, freight trucks, etc., to be swept and sweepings sifted for grain. Soil at Badaev warehouses to be processed for reclamation of sugars. Edible cellulose content in bread to be increased. For urgent action, slaughterhouse byproducts. Edible barks, fungi, berries, peat. Harvesting of vegetable plots from dead zone. Brewer's malt. Domestic pets. Laboratory and zoo animals. Guinea pigs, rabbits, etc. Edible wild plants, especially anti-scorbutics, e.g. nettles, pine needles. Wallpaper paste. Leather articles.
Pavlov hands this new list to his colleague.
Please add your thoughts.
Leather articles?
Some nourishment can be obtained from leather. Of course, we have to set against that nourishment the energy which is required to boil the leather until a stock can be extracted. Apparently, a type of beef jelly can be made from top-quality leather. This is the type of information which people will require as time goes on. So please add your thoughts. It's possible that I have missed something.
Chapter 17. Anna has always loved the first snowfall of winter. She knows as soon as dawn comes that it'll be today. The sky remains dark, with a yellow tinge to the clouds. The light has a sharp, raw edge. Everything is waiting, silent and expectant. Snow will come. The shriveled leaves of autumn, the dying grasses, the chilly, dun-coloured earth will all be covered. The snow will wipe away all mistakes. Light will stream upwards from the immaculate white of the ground. When the first snow falls, Anna always goes to the summer garden. There, the noise of the city is muffled, and the park is eerily luminous. Small, naked-looking sparrows hop from twig to twig, dislodging a powder of snow. The trees are lit up like candelabra by the whiteness they hold in their arms. Underfoot, she hears for the first time the squeak of snow packing into the treads of her boots. She bends down, scoops up a handful of the new snow, throws it up into the air, and watches it scatter into powdery fragments as it falls for the second time. And although she's cold, and she ought to get home, she always stays much longer than she means to, because she knows that this feeling won't come again for another year. The snow will continue to fall, thaw, freeze, turn grey with use, be covered again and again by fresh blizzards, but nothing again will have the freshness, exhilaration, and loneliness of the first snowfall. She's the one thing still warm and alive in a world which is going to sleep. She looks up into the snow which spirals down the steep funnels of the sky, whirls into her face, lands on her eyelashes, and melts into tears. And then she goes back to the apartment, along streets where trams are already thrashing the new soft snow into slush. Children skid around street corners yelling, their faces blazing crimson. Soon it'll be time for skis and sledges. And tomorrow, when she wakes, the snow will be thick and crusted with ice. The sun will be out and all the shadows will be blue. This is how she has welcomed the snow every year of her life. But not this year. The first snow falls on the 14th of October, drifting down through the sky and settling on the ruins of shelled houses, onto tank traps, machine gun nests, and heaps of rubble. The snow is silent, but ominous. No one knows this year whether it will be an enemy or a friend. The Russian winter defeated Napoleon, people say to one another. Perhaps it will defeat Hitler too. A ring of siege grips the city. Nothing comes in, nothing goes out. And in the suburbs, within sight, the Germans have dug themselves in. There they stay, hunkered down for winter in deep trenches, behind defended firing positions. The Germans have always been good at digging trenches, say older Leningraders who fought in the last war. Luxury trenches they have, with carpets and chairs and pictures hanging on the walls. There they squat in the outskirts of Leningrad like wolves at the mouth of a cave. They pour shells onto the city,
but they do not advance any farther. This is blockade.
The Germans eat.
Of course they eat. Through binoculars our boys can see that they are well-muscled and healthy. They move briskly through the chilling air, swinging their arms. They write letters to their families, saying that they'll be home soon, when they've won the war.
Behind them, unbroken supply lines stretch all the way back to Berlin. The Germans are altering their rolling stock to fit Russian railway lines. They have got the harvests of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania on hand, and they can wait as long as they have to. An iron ring squeezes around the besieged city, slowly throttling it.
It's snowing!
Kolya runs to the window, but the exertion makes him cough, and he grabs the back of Anna's chair. She pulls him onto her lap. His face is dusky, and his eyes stream with tears.
How many times have I told you not to rush about like that?
Now, breathe out. Slowly.
That's good. You're doing fine. Another big breath.
He lies back against her shoulder, eyes shut, exhausted. She chafes his hands.
You should keep your gloves on, Kolya. Yes, I know you don't usually wear your gloves indoors, but see how cold it is.
There is no fuel. The electricity is off. The apartment is cold, with the kind of cold you usually encounter on coming home after a long absence in winter. It's a cold that penetrates clothes and upholstery and makes furniture icy to the touch. The beds will not warm. You clamber into them, shivering, and in the morning you ache from trying to keep yourself warm. Your sleep is shallow. It is packed with dreams and refuses to deepen into the bliss of oblivion. Anna puffs out her breath, and a white cloud forms, then disappears.
Marina?
Yes?
What do you think about the Borzoika?
Marina sighs, knitting up her face into lines. She's been trying to read, but her eyesight hasn't been so good these past few weeks. She ought to have reading glasses, if they could be obtained. Her eyes tire quickly, and the lines of print fizz and dazzle. I am turning into an old woman, she thinks. The thought of not being able to read frightens her so much that she pushes it straight out of her mind. I don't know. How much are they asking for it now?
3 days' bread ration, or a kilo bag of sugar and 200 grams of lard.
Plus 500 rubles. Well, the money's no problem. I've got that.
You can't have much left.
No, not a lot, but I've certainly got 500.
But a kilo of sugar?
A whole kilo?
Anna cuts Kolya's bread ration into 3 small chunks. 3 times a day she smears a chunk with sunflower oil, then scatters a thick icing of sugar on it.
Kolya loves sugar.
They have only 2 kilo bags left.
But without the Borzoika, and with winter coming, Anna continues.
This is how she and Marina solve the 100 daily problems of shortages. They think aloud, until the words make some kind of pattern in their tired and hungry minds, and then they find that they have made a decision. They've got to make their minds up, because now the snow's come, the price of these little stoves is shooting up every day.
Is it extra for the stovepipe?
Asks Marina. Yes. Another 2 days' ration, or you can make it up in sugar or coffee.
But on the other hand, if we wait until it gets colder, the price will go up. And maybe they'll run out of Borzoiki, and we won't be able to get one at all.
Kolya begins to cough again. Marina rises, fetches a blanket from the sofa, and wraps it around him, tucking in the edges carefully.
He should be wearing his fur cap, she observes. A high percentage of heat is lost through the head.
I know, but he keeps pulling it off, don't you, Kolya? It's stupid, wearing a cap in the house. Everyone will laugh at me.
I bet they're all wearing their caps now, says Anna. Alyosha, and Shura, and all your friends. They'll all be wrapped up, just like you. She strokes his hair. Listen, I'll pull up a corner of this blanket, and that'll keep your head warm. Like a soldier's helmet. No, don't wriggle. You'll feel much better.
Tell me what Alyosha's doing now. Will he be at nursery? Nobody's at nursery now. It's closed. I thought I was at home because I was ill.
No, you've been at home since long before you were ill. Don't you remember?
Because of the Germans.
It would be too dangerous to go to nursery with all the shelling, even if it was still open.
I wish you would buy us a bazooka, Anna. I'm so cold.
I know.
When's it time for dinner?
Not yet. But Marina's going to make you some of her special drink.
Marina rises. She looks into the other room, where Mikhail lies on his back, very still, apparently sleeping. He hasn't managed to get up today.
It isn't that he's given up again. It's just that he's so weak.
She goes into the kitchen. Although there's no electricity today, they've still got a little oil left. It will last another day, perhaps not more.
They desperately need to get a bouzouika, which can burn anything. Chopped up furniture, books, banisters. They can go scavenging in the parks. They'll be able to keep one room reasonably warm, and heat water for tea, as well as cereal.
By the time Marina brings back Kolya's drink of hot water with a spoonful of honey and a grating of nutmeg, both women have come to the same decision.
"I'll go now," says Anna. "You're right. All the stoves might be gone in the next few days, with this snow falling."
"We'll have to move your father in here. We can't possibly keep more than one room warm, and it's much too cold for him in there."
"Where are you going, Anna?"
asks Kolya anxiously as she settles him on the sofa, still wrapped in the blanket.
"I'm going to get something wonderful for us. A little stove with a long pipe that goes out of the ventilation window. We'll be able to burn wood in it and keep warm even when there's no electricity." "Can I light it?"
"Of course you can. But you have to be very careful because we can't waste matches."
"Anna, will you bring me something to eat?"
"I don't think I can. I don't think I'll be able to carry anything on the sledge except the stove. It's very heavy."
"But I'm so hungry. Please, Anna, can't you just get me a few sweets? You can put them in your pocket and they won't weigh anything."
She sits down on the sofa beside him and puts her arms around him under the blanket. He is still cold, in spite of the layers of clothes and blankets around him. And he's getting thin. Those fine hairs on his legs and arms seem thicker. Isn't that a sign of malnutrition? It didn't help, his having that cold. At least he didn't develop a chest infection. As long as she can keep his chest clear, his asthma won't get too bad. She needs goose fat to rub on his chest at night. It's an old wives' remedy, but it really works. And some eucalyptus oil. But it was wonderful that Andrei managed to get hold of the vitamin C powder. She hugs Kolya more tightly. The shape of his ribs is clear under her hands. When she last undressed him to wash, she saw that the fat had slipped off his buttocks to reveal the distinct outline of his pelvic bone. The bread ration for a child of 5 is only 200 grams a day now. The temptation is to use up their reserves too quickly. There is a sack of potatoes left, 15 onions, 2 jars of honey, the sugar, a jar of lard, and a half bottle of sunflower oil. Before the weather turned cold, Anna searched everywhere for nettles, but she's not sure how much nourishment will remain in the few semi-dried leaves which she has hung between the inner and outer windows for the cold to preserve them. There's been no difficulty in storing the potatoes, after all, now that the apartment is virtually unheated. But if it freezes too hard, they'll blacken and rot. They are well off, compared to many. Anna plans to allow one of the onions to sprout, because Kolya needs the vitamin content of the green shoots. This is the kind of thing she talks to Marina about now. There's no more fake intimacy, no pretending. They are a unit, in spite of everything. If they're going to survive, they'll only survive together. Marina looks after Kolya and her father, while Anna rakes Petersburg for fuel and food. Thank God her father eats very little. For a while she kept on trying to persuade him to eat, preparing cereal with a little honey for him and moistening his bread with sweet tea. But now she senses a change. He wants life more than he's ever done. but it's not his own life he craves any more. It's hers and Collier's. He takes less than his share of the rations, and she no longer tries to persuade him.
"Don't tire yourself, my little one. Conserve your energy," he says to her,
following her with his eyes as she moves through the cold, dark apartment, like someone wading in deep water. Words which she has never heard before flow from his lips. It's as if a spring has been released within him, which was tamped for years so that the water ran deep underground and never surfaced.
"My soul," he calls Anna, "and my bird."
His eyes follow her, and they glow with a life she's never seen in them before. His shoulder wound, which was beginning to heal well, has opened again. But André says there's no infection. It's only that the healing process will be very slow.
"Thank you, my darling," he says,
when she washes the wound with boiled water and dresses it. The words creak hoarsely in his throat, because he doesn't seem able to draw deep enough breaths anymore. But Anna doesn't hear the failing of her father's voice. To her, everything he says now is bathed in meaning, even if she can't understand it any more than she understands the last bubbling of a blackbird's song on a spring night. After she finishes the dressing, she sits and holds his hand. Even when her mother was alive, she never heard these words. Her parents didn't use sweet words. Her father is going back a long way now, to his own grandmother, who took care of him when he was a child, who stroked his cheek, rubbed his chest with goose fat in winter, told him stories by the stove, and lavished words on him like caresses as he drifted between sleep and waking.
"My little pigeon, my blossom, my treasure trove."
For Anna's father, the spirits of the past have come alive. They cluster thickly in the icy spaces of the apartment. Sometimes he can see them, sometimes not. They are not impatient. Sometimes they shift position, and when this happens, he always discovers that they have come closer to his bed. He believes he can hear their thoughts. While he watches frost gather on the inside of the windows, their faces appear out of the patterns. They watch him eagerly, waiting for him to notice them and speak to them. His grandmother's face is there, and the stern, intelligent, bony face of his mother. Only Vera does not come. Not yet. He lies and waits for her. He is sure that she will come, because her children are here. Why has it taken him so long to see that Anna moves just like her mother? Look at the way she bends over Kolya to massage his chest. When he was still well enough to get out of bed, he would lie on the sofa and watch Kolya swallowing his kasha. His eyes followed every movement of Kolya's lips, and his lips moved in unconscious mimicry, chewing on nothing. As the child swallowed his food, so the father swallowed on air.
"Good boy. Keep eating. He'll grow strong."
He's living on tea with sugar.
"It doesn't take much energy to lie around," he said,
and smiled at Anna, a curiously sweet smile, which showed how far his gums had drawn back from his teeth. His skin was yellowish, tight over prominent bones of his forehead and nose. But Kolya wasn't frightened of him anymore. He knew who he was. Sometimes he was allowed to carry his father's tea. "As long as you do it very carefully, Kolya, and don't spill a single drop."
"Dad's getting better," he announced cheerfully, each time he brought back the empty tea glass with a few grains of sugar left in the bottom.
Kolya always swept his finger round the glass to gather the last drops of sweetness and sucked blissfully. Only once did he spill the tea. He had his eyes on his father's face as he carried the glass towards the bed, but he tripped on a ruck in the rug, and hot tea spilled onto his father's chest. Anna heard Kolya cry out, but her father made no sound. When Anna pulled up his woolen undershirt, she saw his waxy skin stained red with the scald.
"Don't worry, Kolya," her father said slowly, wheezing from the shock. "You didn't mean to do it. You'll bring me another glass, eh?"
I'm off then, says Anna. The rubles, sugar, lard and bread are in a cotton bag tied around her waist. Anna made the bag a few days earlier, out of a sheet which was too worn out to be turned sides to middle. She's sewn a flap which buttons down to secure the bag. A bag which you can wear under an overcoat is safer these days than a shopping bag. She'll take Collier's little sledge to carry the stove, the rest of the sheet to cover it, and some torn strips of hem to tie the sheet down. It's best if people don't see what you've got.
Be careful, says Marina. You know how rough it's getting down there.
I'm taking my father's silver cigarette box, in case there's any more vitamin powder.
Does he know?
No. She has known the wording of the inscription on the silver cigarette box since she was 4 years old. Before she could read the words, she used to trace them with her fingers. To my beloved Misha, on the occasion of our marriage. Inside it smells of real tobacco, not mahorka. A spicy, luxurious scent has lingered there for years. He would want us to sell it, but I don't think he needs to know. Marina sucks in her lower lip as she examines the cigarette box.
I wish you weren't going alone. Listen, take this.
She pulls off the ring Anna has admired so often, a rich, glowing ruby set in dark gold. Because the ring has become loose, Marina has wedged a little piece of silk under the gold band to keep it on her finger. Marina twists the ring and the wad of silk falls to the floor.
But Marina, this ring must be worth thousands of rubles. You can't just give it away.
It's worth a stovepipe anyway. Put it in your pocket, not in the bag, so they don't see it. Then you can bring it out if the bargaining gets tough. But take care who sees it.
Anna turns the ring over. Inside the band, there is an inscription in minute lettering. For my Cordelia. Did you play Cordelia?
Obviously.
You should keep this.
Oh, Anna, I played so many roles. I kept it for the stone, not for the inscription. Besides, I never identified with the character. I'm much too aggressive. I would have taken Lear by the shoulders and shaken some sense into him. That kind of vanity amounts to madness, don't you think? All of us are to grovel on the floor, declaring our love for our great leader. But, of course, you have to find a way into every part.
How thin her fingers are, Anna realizes. The bones are skeletally clear on the back of her hands. If it weren't for the silk, the ring would simply have dropped off. Yes, she's thin. And she looks old. I would draw her differently now. It would be a better drawing. Marina, my father, André, Collier, me. We can't separate now, even if we wanted to. I'll be back as soon as I can.
Be careful. Take care of yourself.
Don't forget Collier's massage.
No, I won't forget.
Chapter 18. The wind has dropped. Snow falls straight down in large, soft flakes that blur footprints as soon as they're made. All sounds are muffled, except for the whump of German artillery. The shell bursts are just irregular enough to tear nerves which are already raw with cold and hunger. They are shelling the south side of the city today, at close range. The streets are quiet. A few figures struggle along, muffled into shapelessness, keeping to the safer side of the street. Because the Germans have dug into the south of the city, the northern sides of the streets are said to be the most dangerous. On the safe side, there is some protection from overhanging buildings, as long as there isn't a direct hit close by. This is the theory. The facts of life have been torn up and scattered, so you might as well believe in theory and rumour as anything else. Very probably injuries from blast would be equally bad on both sides of the street. Everyone has stories of people a few metres from the site of an explosion who were miraculously thrown clear, unharmed. And there are stories of others, stripped naked by blast, who died at what should have been a safe distance. If you started trying to find logic in any of it, you'd go crazy. It is hard work walking through the snow. Already, after a few hundred metres, Anna's heart is thudding painfully. She stops to cough.
She's out of breath, and a sweat of weakness starts out over her body, trickling between her shoulder blades. She ought to have tried harder to get hold of some whorehound pastels for this cough, which has been dragging on for 2 weeks now. But when they get a stove, everything will be better. Because she can't walk fast, she isn't keeping warm. Usually her blood seems to flow more brightly in winter. She's buoyant, glowing, always the one who stays in the park long after dusk, hauling children up slopes on their sledge. Winter suits her. Her eyes are bright, her skin clear, her lips red. More than anything, she loves winter nights, with their scent of tangerines and frost and the staring brilliance of stars. But today, the snow is oppressive. Anna's not even sure that she's moving forward. Perhaps only the veil of falling snow is moving, and she herself is treading in the same footprints over and over again. She forces herself on. She's so hungry. Somehow the hunger feels sharper out here. Indoors, you become torpid. You're weak, but you don't understand quite how weak until you try to do something which demands energy. You move slowly and rest a lot, like an invalid. You take time to build up to making tea and lean against the table while the water boils. Hours drift past, glazed. But out here it's frightening. She mustn't rest, not even for a minute, or the cold will get her. Even though there's no wind, the snow seems to be pushing her backwards. Across the street, she sees Clavdia from the nursery laundry, dragging a heavy canvas sack. But Clavdia's eyes stare blankly, or even with hostility, and Anna's greeting dies in her mouth. Was it really Clavdia, or just someone who looked like her? Or perhaps there was no one there at all. You can easily imagine things. Sometimes grains of blackness thicken in front of her eyes. A cluster of falling flakes takes on the shape of a face. At the corner, snow devils are dancing in spite of the lack of wind. Heads down, scattered on the white streets like flakes of soot, a few figures fight their way onward. If she collapsed, no one would be able to help her. No one has the strength. It's hard enough to survive, to get the bread ration, to fetch water if you're in an apartment where the pipes have already frozen, to toil from empty shop to empty shop in search of milk for a sick child. "But I'm fine," Anna says aloud, and tastes a flake of snow on her lips. It's only being alone in the snow that makes her nervous. Her heart's beating so hard. If only she had some valerian drops to